As the news of coronavirus reverberates throughout the world, we at HRN are especially concerned about how coronavirus will impact our food system. We will use our platform to support the restaurant, agriculture, hospitality, and other food-related industries by maintaining our coverage and operations. As social distancing becomes the temporary norm, podcasts are more important than ever. There's never been a more crucial time to stay informed about the state of our food system and the way that food connects our global community. We're sharing all of our COVID-19 coverage at heritageradionetwork.org/COVID-19. From interviews with nonprofit leaders and journalists, to firsthand accounts from chefs and restaurant owners, to reports on how the crisis is affecting regional farms. Our team is working remotely from all over to keep food radio alive. HRN needs your support more than ever to keep sharing essential stories and resources with our listeners. Make a donation of any amount. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers. And this is a strange episode, but we're making it work. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
And I am Valerie Lomas.
And here we are. This is our first remote recording. I'm sitting in my kitchen. Valerie, where are you?
Well, since my whole apartment is kind of one big room, we can say I'm in my study.
In your study, yes,
of course. I'm in my study. My kitchen table, that is also my desk. Yes.
Nice. And we have a funny guest this week who has agreed to be our guinea pig in testing out this new recording system. He is also my co-founder of Burlap and Barrel, but has had a really interesting career path and has bounced around and found himself in food. Ori Zohar. Ori, you want to say hi?
Hello, hello. Excited to be here and to be the guinea pig for this new remote format.
Where are you sitting, Ori?
I'm sitting in my childhood bedroom in Baltimore County. Sure. I've been doing the shelter in place here, where it's me, my brother, and my parents together for the first time for this amount of time since I was in high school. So we're experiencing that.
Yeah. Oh, we've got to talk more about that. How is that going? I'm kind of jealous because I miss my family right now.
You know, there's a lot of like fun, like magical times of us all cooking together and talking together and kind of being like, I wasn't expecting to have this amount of kind of family time, you know, this was unexpected. There's a little bit of reverting, you know, to like playing video games and staying up late and arguing over nonsense. And we're trying to keep that to a minimum. But there's been some really wonderful, unexpected moments of joy from just being together in this difficult time.
Oh, that's really awesome. And it's so funny you mentioned video games because I actually recently bought a Nintendo console. So
it's dangerous right now. You know, I think people are either buying video games, buying insane amounts of flour and beans, or adopting puppies.
Oh my God, you're right about the puppies. There are going to be some like, well, I hope not, but maybe some homeless puppies in about 6 months.
Shala, my wife, has submitted like 50 applications to adopt dogs, so it's very possible in the next few weeks we're going to have a whole pack of dogs living in our very
That's
small
amazing.
Apartment.
Have you guys thought about fostering?
Yeah, apparently it's not. Apparently they're not doing fostering now because I'm sorry. Sorry, hang on. Did you hear that beep?
Yeah.
Yes. All right, let me just turn off the sound. Anyway, let's get into Ori's career and our trip to India. We were supposed to be there for 3 weeks, but because of the coronavirus, we had to come home a few weeks ahead of schedule. But we had a good week there. We met our partner Turmeric Farmer, which was really incredible. We've worked closely with him for a couple of years, but had never met him in person. And we got to visit a mango farm and make plans for our first shipment of Amchur, which is a green mango powder used quite a bit in Indian cooking.
Oh wow. I've been hearing a lot about this green mango powder. That's going to be a really nice spice to add to your collection.
Yeah, it was a spice that I first encountered when I was working for Floyd Cardoz a long time ago, and as you and our listeners may know, he passed away last week of coronavirus. But when I worked at his restaurant Tabla in 2010, it was an ingredient that he used a lot on the menu, and I kind of fell in love with it at that point. And so we're taking advantage of this opportunity to bring it into the country. Hopefully, we found a great farm in an area that's famous for growing mangoes. I was talking to an Indian food writer named Mariam Reshi, who's got a great book about spices, and she described that area, that mango growing area, as the Dom Perignon of mangoes. So
amazing.
They're really good, and we visit this beautiful organic farm in the hills, and they're actually going to use their waste mangoes, the green mangoes that either fall off the tree before they're ripe or get picked accidentally. They're going to use their waste mangoes to make amchur, and this will be their first time producing it at any scale. They've made it for themselves, sort of friends and family in the past, but we're gonna do about 1,000 pounds of it, and we'll see how it goes.
Oh, wow. Okay, so Ori, you and Ethan took this trip together, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think as some of you may know, is kind of Ethan with his background as a chef, and he's kind of in charge of our sourcing. And I think a lot more about our home cooks and some of the U.S. operations of the business and all of that. I think of him kind of as this savvy professional chef, and me as the casual home cook experiencing some of this stuff. So it's been really interesting to go meet the farmers, sleep on the floors of their houses, go to places where sometimes there's running water and electricity and all of that, and really go all the way back to the source and get to know these spices that so often we have absolutely no context for. I've had so many people tell me turmeric is just a yellow powder, or it doesn't have any flavor, right? And then so saying, what is it? Where does it come from? What is the flavor? What should it taste like? And why did it get that way? Is so, so interesting as somebody who just has not come from the food world in the same way.
Well, so, right. Ori, tell us a little bit of that story. How did we wind up doing this together? What were you, walk us through your funny and sort of winding career path.
Right. Cause I mean, you guys are co-founders of one of the up and coming spice companies.
Oh,
right?
Up and coming. We have arrived, Valerie.
Okay.
We
one of the arrived single origin spice companies.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like, when will we know when we have arrived? It's like, I don't know. I know, is there a sign? Is there a ticker tape parade? When, like, I don't know.
I think it's when you're out in the Wall Street Journal and Bon Appetit and everything else all at the same time.
Yeah. For me, it's when we have enough money in the bank account to pay salaries that are not embarrassing to all my friends. And we'll get there. We're working on it. But Ethan and I have been friends for a long time. You know, we met when I first moved to New York out of college, and Ethan was working in restaurants and cooking, and I was always just trying to hang out wherever he was doing that. I was always on the eating side of the equation, and we kind of became friends over a shared love of food. And as Ethan was working in these restaurants, I would hang out at the bar and have drinks and wait for him to get off his shift. And then we'd sneak into the kitchen and he'd cook some stuff up from the fridge. And it was just like, it was such a crazy adventure for me. I'd never seen the food world from that side. You know, I always cooked at home growing up and with the family, and food was a big part of that. But I'd never seen the professional side of kitchens in that way. And I was really enamored by that. And then in 2010, we had started Gorilla Ice Cream, an ice cream business together. You know, Ethan had worked, of course, at a few excellent restaurants, including a Tabla under Chef Floyd. And we had started an ice cream business that was flavors inspired political movements and revolutions from around the world. And Ethan and I kind of found a good balance in our partnership where he was making these amazing ice cream flavors. We wanted things to be new in terms of ice cream flavors, but accessible and familiar from just in the whole world of flavors and stuff that you've tasted. And we had a really fun time for 4 months building this ice cream business through the summer of 2010 in New York. And we got a lot of press and people were excited, and we were being a little bit silly and over the top with the flavors, and they were all inspired political movements and revolutions. And we donated all of our profits in lieu of salaries to ourselves to the Street Vendor Project. to support who was a nonprofit that was supporting street vendors in their kind of holding a place on the streets of New York. And so after that, you know, we know Ethan went on his way to get his master's degree in London and over to Afghanistan as an aid worker and brought spices back. I had said, you know what, this is my chance to do the next startup. Because in college, I had done some entrepreneurial projects, even younger than that. My parents had bought me a 3-CD changer boombox, and I said, I know what I'm going to do with this. I started DJing, you know, parties for people younger than me. Like, the 16-year-old was DJing 13-year-olds' parties. And I was like, you know what, guys? Maybe I don't have all this fancy equipment, but I know what music is hip right now. And so I got some gigs. Anyway, so I'd always had this, like, entrepreneurial path, and I you know, Gorilla Ice Cream was the first time that it was legitimized, where I was like, oh my God, I can do this. There's this entrepreneurial path. And I think that entrepreneurship has a lot to do with kind of like getting reps in. And like, the more you do it, you don't have to wait for this perfect storm of idea and this and that. Like, I just had enough practice and had seen a few businesses that I was like, okay, what's next? And I had met these two folks out of Switzerland that had started a mortgage company, and they offered me to join them in Switzerland. And I said yes, and then I said no, and then we just stayed in touch. And they said, you know what, how about this? Do you think there's an opportunity to start a mortgage company in the US? And I said, I don't know, but let me take a look. And I got introduced to a co-founder, and we started this mortgage company in the US that was basically like a super broker. Most brokers work with 3 to 5 lenders. Most people that get their mortgage have no idea what points are, what APR is, what you should get. And there's kind of an advantage that's taken of that kind of lack of knowledge on behalf of the home buyers, that mortgage people end up giving you stuff that they get paid the most on. And so we tried to take that out of the equation. And so we made this like super broker. You'd come to us. Our folks weren't paid based off of your loan size. And this was meant to be like a much friendlier, more transparent, more honest approach to getting a mortgage. And I moved to San Francisco to do that because my co-founder of that business was out there. And we ended up running it for 4 years and raised $32 million. And we did $500 million worth of mortgages, which is not enough to keep a company like that afloat. And after all that, we had a Series C signed, which is our fourth round of investments. And the investors were kind of tricking us. They were waiting for us to go bankrupt, you know, while we were having these negotiations, and to try to keep us from talking to other folks. And we kind of wised up to this pretty late in the process. And at that time, we had to cut the company way back, and we're looking for more money to just stay afloat. Because this is like the classic, you know, San Francisco, Bay Area, you know, grow quickly, spend money, just go, go, go as fast as possible, no matter what. And at that point, we ended up getting 2 offers to getting the company acquired. And so we kind of sold it. My co-founder stayed on as a transition. I jumped off and kind of was kind of trying to figure out what was the next thing to do. And at that point, Ethan had been bringing spices in from Afghanistan. He'd built relationships with a few other farmers that were doing these beautiful single origin spices that the commodity market didn't really care about and didn't really value. And so he had brought those over. He had flown over to San Francisco. We sat with some chefs at some restaurants like Nopa. And I just saw them like getting so excited about these flavors. And that was such a, like a light bulb moment, that if chefs are getting this excited about spices that Ethan had been sourcing, but literally like at that point, sourcing was right, traveling over there, yeah, bringing them back in his checked luggage.
I didn't
right?
know anything. I had no idea what I was doing.
We saw their eyes light up and saying, if these chefs that have access to all the best ingredients in the world are getting this excited about what Ethan's brought back, not only is there an amazing opportunity to bring spices in, but there's for chefs, but there's also this amazing opportunity to do it for home cooks. And if the model works, that single origin spice that's happened in coffee and tea and chocolate and wine and, you know, all these other industries, in produce and meat, people now know where their meats are coming from. It just had not happened at all in spices. So we said, this is the thing to do. We can do it by paying the farmers more, creating a public benefit corporation, and kind of we were off to the races. But to Ethan's credit, I mean, he had spent over a year already like building those supply chains and talking to farmers and testing the concept out with chefs, and had already started selling. And I, the first year, I was just kind of watching from the side and helping out as much as I could before I finally left the company, took a little bit of time to just get my head back on my shoulders, and then was able to join Burlap and Barrel full time.
Yeah, you didn't trust that I was going to be able to get it off the ground, but that's okay. No hard feelings. I'm over it. I tell people that it took me a year to convince you to be my co-founder, and then I succeeded, I guess.
So I guess
and then I was in.
Right.
So I have a question. So you guys were the first single origin spice company. Are you still the only ones? And for people who may not have had burlap and barrel single origin spices yet, what is the draw of single origin spices?
That's such good questions,
Valerie.
Why is
that better than a grocery? Like, why is that better than what I can get at Whole Foods?
Yeah. So we weren't the first single origin spice company, and we're definitely not the only one, but what we are is the only comprehensive single origin spice company. So other companies tend to source from one country or carry one product. They have a connection there. Maybe they're from there. Like that's the line that they're building. But what we do that's different is we go to a lot of countries, and it's really about the product and about being able to maximize our impact, supporting farmers around the world rather than in just one place. And Ori, you want to talk about what makes our spices better?
Yeah. And I think also part of it was a decision to say that, like, if we can convince you to buy a single spice from us, like, how do we just make sure that if you already like our spices, how do we make sure we can kind of fill up your pantry, that we can get you an order that then we can offer you free shipping on, and kind of you say, oh, you like chilies? Well, you're going to love cinnamon. Oh, you love, like, if we can get you in, how can we just make sure that we can get you all the other stuff that you could possibly need in kind of in one fell swoop? And so we don't have a ton of spices. Like, we have about 45 different spices that we source, and we're trying to do a good curated list of what will be good for most home cooks or professional chefs or food makers. We've kind of been playing around with that and retiring things and bringing new things.
Well, also, it just seemed a little boring to focus on, like, we get excited about new spices. We're traveling around the world. We're spending time with farmers. Farmers will say, yes, well, my primary crop, this is what happened in Guatemala with our partner farmer there. My primary crop is cardamom, but I also grow these incredible chilies. And so why wouldn't we import those chilies as well? And that's happened in a lot of places, and that's been fueled both by our culinary curiosity and excitement about trying ingredients and varieties of ingredients that we haven't tasted before. And then also, I think, was fueled by our customers a customer emailed me yesterday asking about mustard seeds, which we don't currently carry. So we get a lot of questions. People are always looking for their favorite, a better version of their favorite spice, and come to us to see if we carry it. So we just like to make it difficult for ourselves, but it's totally worth it.
Right. Yeah. You think it's easy to manage one supply chain, try importing from 14 different countries.
We've got shipments on the water from 6 different countries right now. And I am really nervous that we're going to have issues with the customs coming into the country because of coronavirus anyway.
Interesting. So I think you guys just tapped into, like, I mean, what's probably obvious to you guys, but may not be obvious to some of us who aren't as naturally entrepreneurially minded, which is there was a hole in the market. And I say hole in the market kind of loosely because, I've had the great pleasure of trying some of your spices, and it felt like, oh, this is the spice that I didn't know was missing from my cabinet, which is really exciting because it's like you kind of created a hole in the market and now you're filling it with stuff we didn't even know we wanted.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a little bit of like storytelling in retrospect. But you asked what makes it different from the grocery store spices, and most spices come from these like massive importers. And by the time they get into your kitchen or even into your grocery store, they've changed hands 15 to 20 times. Years have passed. Good and bad batches got mixed together. There's this whole idea of where did this come from? You can sometimes see on some spice boxes, you're like, where is the source from? They're like, well, these peppercorns came from Brazil, Vietnam, this country, that, like, you know, like the source cannot be 5 different countries, but that's just the reality of how this is coming in. And we've seen this like change happen in everybody else's pantries where you know where everything comes from, right? Coffee used to just be black coffee, and now we're getting Guatemalan shade grown medium roast, and it's excellent coffee. And this just revolution hasn't happened in spices yet, where the same systems for bringing spices into the country are still in in place from hundreds and hundreds of years ago, the same, you know, stories of where these come from and exotic lands and authentic this and like all this like crazy story of like why this special is still kind of in place in pretty funny ways. And so that's the biggest difference, is that instead of the spices going through this really complex supply chain that nobody knows where they came from, good and bad lots get mixed together. There's all these reports of adulteration in spices. At some point there was like, you know, oregano, 25% of the oregano that this study sampled had other stuff in it. Sometimes
like
it was strawberry leaves. Sometimes it was olive leaves. And in fact, like about, you know, 50 years ago, oregano was used to adulterate other things because it was low value. And so it's just this crazy thing. So instead what we do is we work directly with these farmers that really care about what they're growing and are growing things that are way better than what you can find, you know, in the average from just people that are selling to the commodity market. They're frustrated that the commodity market doesn't care and isn't willing to pay for the really exceptional spices that they're growing in their very special way, because they're saying, you know what, I think that this should ripen on the vine for longer. I think I should wait longer until harvesting this. I think this should be done organically or only with rainwater or whatever it is. Each of the farmer has their own kind of MO for how they're growing these spices and what makes them exceptional. And the commodity market comes by and says, hey, you know what, we're paying $1 per kilogram for everybody no matter what. Just tell us how much weight it is. We don't care. And so we work directly with these smallholder farmers. We pay them way more. We send trucks directly to their farms and fields, set them up to be their own exporters, which no one does. And because of that, we're able to bring really fresh, recently harvested, really high quality spices to people's home kitchens. And for folks that haven't had a chance to taste it, I think of it like we've all had those apples from the grocery store that were like, this tastes barely like an apple. And then we have that apple from the farmer's market and we're like, oh, right, there it is. We're just trying to do the same thing with spices.
So yeah, that's oh, go ahead, Ethan. We can't see each other, so it's kind of hard to pick up on our cues, but go ahead, Ethan.
Usually we wave our hands at each other and make faces during the whole recording process, which I'm still doing, even though you can't see me. But anyway, tell us about sort of the process of building a company in a field that didn't really exist before. There was maybe one other single origin spice company with a single spice. They only had one thing when we started the company. Neither one of us came from the spice industry, and you, other than the ice cream experience, had not had a lot of experience working in food, and definitely not in e-commerce, in wholesale, in imports, in a very logistics heavy business. What was it like, I don't know, in those early days when we started working together on this? What were the challenges? What were you surprised by?
Yeah, so in the first year where it was Ethan running the operations and me kind of looking from the outside and trying to just size it up and understand what was going on, you know, what we said, like the first thing was to say, how do we figure out how to just bring spices from a farm in a remote area into the US? And so what does Ethan do, right? Register his living room with the FDA as a spice processing facility. And on one hand, that seems ridiculous and not scalable and all this stuff that entrepreneurs love to talk about. And on the other hand, it gave us all the information that we needed to just get like almost like a prototype, like a small version up and running of seeing like, who are the farmers? Are they willing to sell to us? Who are the customers? Are they willing to buy from us? And just answer a lot of these early stage companies, answer all these early stage questions. And so for me, like coming from a company that was venture backed and like grow, we had over 100 employees. We had an entire marketing team, an entire tech team, an engineering team building as fast as we possibly could. This was really refreshing to look at this and say, okay, there's an opportunity here. What is really the low cost way? What is the minimum that we need to kind of test this out? What are our hypotheses? What do we think is going on here? And how do we do it in a really low cost way? You know, because we didn't have access to millions of dollars and we didn't have access to tons and tons of investors. We were just trying to figure out how to get this off the ground. And I love to like build systems and build like organized things and figure out like what are margins and what are like, but so many entrepreneurs I know like spend all day long building these crazy overwrought business plans and projections and 5 years and all that stuff. And guess what? Within 1 month of actually doing it, you find out that all those projections are wrong. And like, so really what I loved about this business, and maybe it was just a reaction from my last business, which was, you know, crazy and grow, was to say, you know, I think in early days we talked about this, is like, put in enough money to get some spices into the US, sell those, see what we learned, buy more, and just keep that process going. And it was really a, like, I think so many people look for this like magic bullet, or do I need to do $1 million on Instagram ads next month and that's my way to success? And instead we just did this kind of like iterative process where every time, like, the site first was really goofy, and I don't know who would buy from us, but these early adopters saw this and were like, huh, this is like, I'll give them a chance. And then we just, every week, things just got a little bit better, a little bit more professional. We got to know what we were doing. We figured out what prices we need to charge in order to both kind of get home cooks to get excited about it and be within reach, but also give us enough money to buy the next shipment of spices. And so instead of this like crazy grand plan, it's really easy to like look back and look at these big companies and be like, how do I build a Starbucks today? And then say, I have no idea. And instead, it's much easier, I think, to say, I have nothing. What do I need to do to have something? And then make that something a little bit better every single time that we do it. And that was really fun and really encouraging. And the customers that bought from us in the early days were really supportive, because they saw a company with a goofy site with no history, no reviews, photographs from our kitchen tables of the spices spilling out, you know, and all. And they said, this is a company that I'm curious about, that I'm willing to give a chance. And those were really amazing customers. We emailed all of them, asked them questions on what we could do better, what they were expecting. And over time, we were able to move out of Ethan's living room and into a packing facility. And out of Ethan's living room is a shipping center and into a warehouse. And we were able to build all that stuff over time. But I can't overstate how valuable it was to just kind of get more information by doing. And so many people spend so much time planning and thinking and modeling and this and that, where the really most valuable thing you can possibly do is just get to it and see what people think about it and build from there.
Wow, that sounds like you guys really just built it kind of organically in a way.
I think people are constantly thinking about like a magic formula or like the secret thing or all that stuff. And honestly, like, it's not, I can't overstate the value of like kind of iterative design. Sounds boring. So let's just say like just the value of kind of rolling your sleeves up, trying it out, getting feedback, and just getting better every single time you do it. It's much more valuable than trying to go for this crazy launch.
Building theoretical models.
Totally.
Okay, let's take a quick break and we're going to come back. And I know I have a ton more questions, so stay tuned.
I don't have any more questions.
During this time, it's more important than ever to support our friends and neighbors in the restaurant industry. Restaurant Workers Community Foundation has set up a national COVID-19 Crisis Relief Fund. The money they raise will provide direct relief to individual restaurant workers, support other nonprofits serving restaurant workers in crisis, and offer zero-interest loans for restaurants to get back up and running. Visit restaurantworkerscf.org to donate today. And if you need a little extra motivation, you can DM your $20 donation to RWCF's co-founder, John DeBerry, on Twitter, and he'll give you directions for making a signature quarantine cocktail. Donate now at restaurantworkerscf.org.
Okay, so we're back with Ori Zohar, co-founder of Burlap and Barrel, our very own Ethan's co-founder and business partner. So Ori, I know you guys just got back from India. You mentioned you have, you know, you source from 14 different countries. Do you guys actually get to go and visit each of the farms in each of the countries? And I mean, what is that like? That sounds like the dream, being able to travel the world for business and find these unique spices and farmers and get their stories. What is it actually like doing this kind of travel for work?
I can give you so Ethan, right? Ethan's area is sourcing, right? And that's, he works with all the farmers and he builds these relationships and all of that. And I feel like I get to be kind of like, I get to join for these trips, which is a blast because this is important for me because as saying about like what's on the site, how do we tell the story, you know, and all, and that's really, really fun and interesting. We got to go, on. So Ethan does a lot of the traveling and I join whenever I can. That's my kind of rule. And so the first trip that I got to join for was going on a sourcing trip to Zanzibar in Tanzania. And like, I got off of this, I don't know, 14-hour flight over to Istanbul. We didn't even leave the airport. And I walked across and saw Ethan. And then we flew from there into Tanzania, and then had to we slept in a hotel for 4 hours and then got on a boat to go across to get into Zanzibar. And like, it's this really crazy world, right? Because farmers are often growing where there's a lot of land available, which by definition is in these more remote areas, and getting to them is quite a trip. And all my friends basically think that I'm going to like Club Med, right? I'm like sitting there drinking Mai Tais and I don't know, just like hanging out by the beach. And it's so different in such an interesting way, in that like you can't sign up for these trips. You can't just decide that, you know, you're gonna go and just hang out and spend time with farmers. But just for example, when we first got into Zanzibar, step one is they said, hey, we need to see your yellow fever vaccinations. And they held us in this like, and I didn't need it, and Ethan had it, and it was like a little bit of a shakedown thing going on. And so it's like, welcome to Zanzibar. We're gonna sit in this small room while we figure our way out to get into the country, because they saw foreigners coming in and we're like, we think we can get some money out of these guys. But then we go into this beautiful city called Stonetown and see the old stone.
Hang on, I just have to jump in. They picked the wrong foreigners to try to shake down, and we waited them out and did not pay the bribe that they were looking for, but had a very funny interaction with the nurse who was trying to get the bribe out of us, where we just refused, and we sat there until she got bored and let us leave, which is how I recommend
it. It's crazy now thinking about you know, how we can end up potentially bringing diseases around the world when we travel, or picking them up and bringing them back home.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's exactly what happened in India a few weeks ago. The Indian government started putting restrictions on foreigners' travel because coronavirus had been brought in by American tourists and Italian tourists and Indians who'd been living in Italy and came back. And we saw very quickly that it was going to be A, difficult for us to get around just logistically, but B, people were going to be nervous about us being there. And that wasn't something we wanted anybody to feel, and that we weren't going to be able to have the kinds of conversations that we like to have and that we need to have if people were going to be nervous knowing that we had just come from New York. So that was a big part of the decision to cut the trip.
But you guys did eventually make it into Zanzibar.
Sorry, right. Back to Zanzibar.
So when you think about a spice farm, like, and you picture it in your mind, like, what are you thinking of, right? I don't know. Valerie, what do you think the spice farms look like?
Okay, well, I've seen pictures of Stonetown and Zanzibar, but I would imagine, like, well, I've been to, like, pepper farms in Louisiana, which is a little different, but I would imagine, like, rows of bushes growing things.
Totally. And right, that's like most of the farms, right, that we know, the big commercial farms, like you see rows of corn that go like as far as your eyes can see. And in Zanzibar, it was totally different. It was almost like a forest or like a jungle where you had vanilla vines growing off of cinnamon trees. The farmers had planted, had kind of set up bees, you know, around to like help pollinate and get the honey. And so it was almost like a jungle that the farmers were taking care of. And each one had their own part of the jungle that they were growing and building a nursery and having a central drying area and all of that. And so it was really like we just hiked for an hour to get to this like central area to see where they were growing cinnamon and watching the vanilla flowers, how they were opening up and pollinating them and you know, all spices just growing around there, just randomly, you know, passing by it. And so it was really, it was way different than I had expected. It was much more so of this like really cool, like everything is growing together all over each other in this relatively dense area. And the farmers were these expert guides that were wielding machetes and leading us deeper and deeper in and walking through and explaining with like love, you know, what makes the cinnamon so special and why they were using these techniques to help this tree still grow and taking down only one branch at a time. And they were just really kind of guiding us through this area. And it was so impressive. And also it smelled amazing. just the whole time you're going through like a spice growing area.
It like was a really, cinnamon really beautiful. Vanilla forest.
Yeah, yeah. You're not mad about how it smells there at any point. And so it was just really, really cool to jump into these areas that I didn't even know existed, but looked so much less like traditional farms. And having these expert guides walking through here and walking us through why they've been doing this for generations and what their families had passed down to them and why this is growing this way and which plants grow well together and when they bring in cattle and when they bring in sheep to graze stuff and all of these things was just so super, super interesting to kind of jump into this world. And also the reality is that spices can be more expensive because there's not a lot of animal labor. There's not a lot of machine labor involved in the process. So much of it is done by hand. So much of it is done by caring for these plants and trees and flowers and done in relatively small quantities. And so it was just kind of a reality from this like industrial manufacturing world to this world where things were really just done by default across the world by hand and in small batches and naturally.
So it does sound like you guys are living the dream with your travels. Like it might not be like a typical resort kind of situation, but you're getting to delve deep into these like unique once in a lifetime cultural experiences.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to go to places that like there aren't restaurants, right? In some, so you eat in the farmers' homes, and it's such an honor to have a farmer bring us into their homes. Ethan always travels with a medicinal bag that would rival most paramedics. But we're able to, you know, just you have to be careful around things that our stomachs may not be used to. You know, when we were in Vietnam, we ended up sleeping on the floor of a farm where we had to kind of push some chickens aside to go to the bathroom, like all this stuff. So there are definitely some things that we've had to get used to, but it's really such an interesting, you know, thing to do that I don't know how else I'd have access to this.
I mean, so much of what we do winds up being relationship building and meeting people, both literally and figuratively, where they are. And especially when we're setting up a new relationship with a partner farmer, it's about a meeting of business owners, a meeting of entrepreneurs to say, here's your business, here's our business, here's how they can work together. Let's talk this through. Let's see how we feel about that and what you're looking for and what we're looking for. And I think that's one of the reasons that having Ori, you know, I come from a food background. I knew a fair amount about spices before. I have learned a lot about spices over the last few years. But having Ori's experience as a, I don't know, can I call you a serial entrepreneur? Is that
sure.
aren't all entrepreneurs serial entrepreneurs?
Yeah, fair enough. But to be able to do this with somebody like Ori, who has the repeated experience of entrepreneurship and has built several different kinds of businesses. Actually, you know what? I'm going to stop talking and let Ori talk about this because I know he has a grand theory of entrepreneurship that I'm sure he'd like to share.
Oh, my grand unifying theory of entrepreneurship.
Yes.
I think that so some of the magic that what I appreciate, you ask me about business, I talk about how what I appreciate and what Ethan brings. And so, I think what's been really amazing has been this kind of balance. I think you see like two types of entrepreneurs, right? You have one that's the subject matter expert. That person that digs deep, right? That's like, you know, in every tech company, there was that like brilliant coder that built this prototype that worked really beautifully. Or, you know, in a law firm, you have the most senior lawyer or whatever it is. And so I think you always have these subject matter experts. And I see a lot of food entrepreneurs that they have it. They're excellent bakers. They're excellent, you know, chefs or cooks or whatever that may be. Maybe they know how to, you know, blend or this or that, whatever. They make cookies or pizzas or whatever that their entire neighborhood and community was like, oh my God, you have to turn this into a business. And you need that. You need to have somebody that's so deeply knowledgeable that brings that expertise to it. And I think in this way, like that's Ethan, like he brought in, he says, hey, this cardamom is exceptional. It's better than anything else that I've tasted. We were in Vietnam and we tasted the cinnamon, this is the royal cinnamon that we now have. And we bought 1,000 kilograms of it on the spot because, you know, we tasted it and it was like, oh my God, this is magic. This is a really special product. And we know how people are going to use it and get excited about it. And if basically chefs are going to get excited about it, that's a pretty good mark that home cooks are going to absolutely love it too. And I think that where some of these entrepreneurs can also run into like a block is when you say, okay, I've done this. I have the best cookies in the world. I'm slinging pizzas better than anybody else. But at the end of the day, the other part of it is also then how do I turn this into a business and how do I run it and what do I need to charge and what are my margins and how do I communicate to my customers and all of that. And so, you know, our partnership has really been built on that, where we have Ethan with his amazing subject matter expertise and working with farmers and identifying these really exceptional spices. And then I'm on the other end and trying to think about, okay, what does this look like? What are our customers asking us for? How do we sell this? How do we position it? How do we price it? What do we need to do? How does all that work? And so what I love to do is to create these systems, right? And so how do we, because if we need to have a successful business, we need to do the same thing over and over again. How do I make sure that I can sell over and over again? How do I make sure that I don't do one sale? How do I do 50 sales a month, then 1,000 sales a month? And, you know, like, how do I build this up? And what do we need to do to create a sustainable and repeatable version of that? And so what's been really fun is to say, okay, how do we tell the story of the cinnamon in our newsletter? How do we tell it on our site? What can we do to get folks excited about this? And so that's, I think, where our partnerships are, is I think Ethan's always creating, right? And I love that. He's way better than me at like doing the like zero to one, that like it doesn't exist to now it exists. And then I like to take that and say, okay, now how do we do this? But how do we do it for 10,000 jars of cinnamon? How do we do it for 1,000 kilograms? How do we build this into a repeatable business where we're able to keep financing it, where we can keep paying our farmers way above market rates, how we can pay them ahead of the harvest or right when stuff loads on the boat instead of asking them to finance it? And so that's a lot of what keeps me kind of occupied, is to say, how do we turn this from this like really cool one-off or small-scale thing, how do we build it up and make it accessible to all the home cooks in America? How do we make sure that we can be shipping double the quantities? How do we make sure that our jars don't break in the shipment? How do we tell the story in a more accessible way? And that's been really fun. That's been the really fun challenge of all of this. And how do we build it as a healthy business? Because even if you have the best stuff in the world, you know, the next question is then how do we get it to people in a consistent way? And that's been, that's like, that brings me joy to solve that problem.
Amazing. Thank you. I love that you distilled something really simple, but people might, who are not necessarily entrepreneurs, might not kind of think about on a regular basis, but it's like, you need both. You need like the expertise and you also need the execution. And I think you both have the passion, which might be kind of like the extra sauce on top.
We have very different skill sets. And I think that, and we approach problems in very different ways. We joke that, you know, ask us both the same question, we'll just do totally different things to figure out what the answer is. I'll read a couple of books or call up some people I know who know more than I do. And Ori will do a ton of research and build out a spreadsheet and a model. And we'll come back together and often have a very similar answer, but having used very different methods to get there.
Yeah, I think we have a set of shared values we have a shared vision also in the business that we want to build and what success looks like and what does that have to involve. And then we go on our separate paths to kind of get to the same place. And I also think that there's a lot of food entrepreneurs that say, but how do I turn this into a business? And I think that there's a lot of business people that are like, I want to do something in food, but I don't know where to get started or I don't know where to go. And I think that there's much more opportunity for kind of a connection between those two types of people. And that's where there's some magic that can happen. And if you're a food person, find your business person. And if you're a business person, find your food person. And that'll help you make that magic happen.
That's really great advice. I'm looking for my business person. If there's anyone out there, hit me up.
It changes everything, let me tell you.
Yeah, but I think there's also this like tension, right? There, like, it's a good tension to have where Ethan and I always will look at stuff and we come to it and we like, I think I can be a little bit too like structured, like it doesn't fit in the model. Why are we doing it? And Ethan's like, if it's in the model, then I am bored doing it. I want to do the next thing. I want to break the model. And it's actually been really rewarding because I think we're both a little bit too extreme in our own ways. And then we talk and we mull things over and we argue and we pull and push in different ways. And then we land in this place in the middle that just ends up being this kind of elegant and wonderful solution that both stretches us to the next new thing. And I think that's what I really appreciate about Ethan is constantly trying to think, what's next? What do we do? And I'm constantly thinking about how do we do what we do today, but better. And we keep pushing and challenging each other to grow beyond our own comfort zones. And I think that that's also part of the magic and the fun that gets there. And, you know, as in any relationship, right, we both bring different and wonderful things to the table that helps us grow and helps us figure out the next new thing to do.
And we bicker all the time, just like any relationship. But we, but the bickering I find is very productive and
really productive bickering.
Yeah, right. Exactly, productive bickering. Should we do a little rapid fire and then wrap up?
Yeah, let's do it.
Or are you ready for some fun questions?
Oh my god!
Up to this point, not fun at all.
Okay, I'll do the first question. Since you've been hanging out with your family and you guys have been cooking together, what's something that you've cooked with your family recently where you got to use some cool burlap and barrel single origin spices?
Nice plug, Valerie.
Yeah, great. you know, we've been really thinking about how to get the most out of all the ingredients that we have here because, you know, we don't want to do more trips to the grocery store. In reality, do more orders from the grocery store, right? Anything comes in, we have to sanitize it. We have to, you know, go through the whole process. And so we've been trying to like make the most out of everything and use it in more and more things. So we've been just digging through the pantry and trying to figure out what's next. Banana bread, I think, has been on the menu at a lot of households as anything. Like bananas starting to go bad, we know what to do with it. I've been Rancho Gordo beans have been my like, I'm like hoarding them, right? I'm just like holding on to them because I don't want to run out. And I know that they've been hammered with orders. And so we've been doing a lot of like pots of beans and throwing paprika in there. Black lime is an awesome topper for the beans. A lot of the herbs like oregano or the flowering hyssop thyme. And just trying to do these like simple, hearty one pot meals. And then like you have a little bit of mushrooms left over, throw them in the pot of beans. We had a little bit of shaved coconut that God knows how old it is, goes in the banana bread. And so we've been cooking all these dishes that just kind of take all these scraps and goodies and other stuff that we're finding around the house and just makes the most of them.
Follow up to Valerie's question. What are the biggest differences you've seen in the last week or a couple of weeks with your parents in the way that you cook and the way that they cook?
So I think that we've been a pretty traditional household in that, like, it seems like most households in America are going through a very similar kind of phases of saying like, okay, I'm home, I'm cooking a lot. What are cooking things that I never had time for that now I want to dig into? So literally there's an olive and garlic loaf in the oven right now because my dad decided that he wants to try baking and it's great. You know, maybe not for my waistline or health, but we're eating a lot of fresh baked home bread and that's been really wonderful. We've been doing a lot of long cooking things like, you know, stews and the beans count as this and, you know, throwing eggs in there and all that. And that's been kind of fun because if you're home all day and you can throw something on the stove for 10 hours, you just get it started in the morning and you check on it and all that. That's been really fun. And we're just trying to, you know, get more creative with what else because we're starting to go a little crazy under the monotony. So we're kind of looking around the kitchen and looking around the pantry and the fridge and saying, What haven't I done before? What other magic can I make out of these existing ingredients here?
Nice. Valerie, we want to do another one?
Sure. Let's do another question. What's next? Once you're out of quarantine, Ori, what's next for you? This isn't quite rapid, but...
So you guys are catching me at a funny time because I packed up my apartment in San Francisco. I moved out, we flew to India, and the goal was to move to New York after we got back from India. And what ended up happening is I spent a week on Ethan's couch, and then I went down to my parents' house in Baltimore. And so I'm en route to move back to New York after 7 years of San Francisco. It'll be really fun. Ethan and I have been remote co-founders for the entirety of this business. And so it'll be both wonderful and challenging for us to be in the same city. I'm excited to be able to see Ethan more often instead of us just getting on very long phone calls or just shooting messages on WhatsApp between the moment we wake up to the moment we close our eyes. But I'm very excited to kind of reacquaint myself in New York and get to know the city and call it my home again.
Awesome. Yeah. I'm excited that you're moving here. I met you briefly. We ran into each other at a food show because I think I had on Ethan's name tag.
like you do.
You know, the black market in name tags at food trade shows.
We won't name the food trade show.
I'm also excited to have Ori here. I think this move has been in the works for a long time, and I think it'll be really nice for us and our relationship, and also really nice for the business to have us both in the same place working away. But in the meantime, I'm in New York and he's in Baltimore, and the business is chugging along as best it can.
any parting thoughts?
If I had a superpower, I'm just kidding. What's your superpower?
Go on and finish now that you've started.
oh God. let's see. I think it would be the ability to be invisible, and I'll tell you why. I think it's so, like, we ask our customers so many questions of, like, why do you do this? How do you, like, I'm just so curious about, like, I just want to be in somebody's kitchen and see how they interact with spices and how they're cooking and what they're talking about. Like, it's just so interesting, right? You know, when you've, like, you get to go to somebody's, like, childhood bedroom, which I'm currently in, and you're like, oh, I understand. I understand how you grew up. I understand the adult that this kid turned into, right? And so I'm just really curious and just like hearing more and seeing and kind of being a fly on the wall in so many of people's interactions. I think you get to hear so much more than when people are kind of on the spot and you're asking them these direct questions. They like say kind of what they want to be, or they answer kind of aspirationally instead of like actually seeing what they're doing and how they're doing it and all that. And I would love to just kind of sit in on so much more of those like cooking sessions and conversations and things like that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Ori. It was really great to talk to you. And Ethan, it's great to be back making podcasts with you. It's been like over a month.
Yeah, it has. It's been too long. But we've got some cool guests lined up for upcoming episodes that I'm really excited to talk about. And I hope all of our listeners are really excited to hear from. And Valerie, even if we can't hang out in person, at least we get to hang out over this podcasting platform.
That's right.
You can visit our website, burlapandbarrel.com. I'm doing this for Ori. you can follow us on Instagram at burlapandbarrel. You can follow Ori's Instagram account at ozohar, where he posts funny pictures of him and me and other things that we're doing and seeing, especially when we're traveling. And as always, you can reach us about the podcast by emailing us whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. I check it every day. We love to hear from you. You can follow me via The Spice Company at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram.
And you can follow me on social everywhere at Foodie in New York.
Thanks to our themes. Thanks to Red Crickets for our theme song, which is called Blind, and to our awesome and remote sound engineer, Matt Patterson. I don't know, Valerie, anything else?
See you guys next week.
See you next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.